He printed the first Bibles, which are called Gutenberg Bibles, but by then Gutenberg was out of it. And a year after that, Faust and his partner printed the first music book. They actually just succeeded in printing a line of staves, and copyists wrote the notes in by hand after that. But it is the first edition of printed music. 20 years after that, sorry, 8 years after that, Johannes Gutenberg died, penniless. Meanwhile, his Bibles and his presses were all over Europe. He would have seen that happening in those 8 years. 20 years after that, Faust the printer died, a wealthy man. Now, about the same time, in Heidelberg, another Faust was born, the man who became known as Dr. Faustus of legend, who had, the legend tells us, formed a pact with the devil for supernatural powers. And when he died, witnesses claimed, and there were many of them, who said they were there when the floor opened up in the tavern, and amid acrid smoke and stinging sulfur, screaming, Faustus was dragged down to hell by the devil himself. Now, that story became the first bestseller in the Faust book. True? First bestseller, anonymous author. It's called the Faust book, and it was printed on Gutenberg presses. Within 10 years of that, a string of Faust books was published. Plays, stories, manuals with careful instructions on how to avoid a bilateral pact with the devil and how to get out of one in case you couldn't avoid it. The classic of the genre was Magia Naturalis et Innaturalis. Johann von Goethe, the great romantic poet, German romantic, read that one, and his 1808 play forever linked the name of Faust with the devil. So, who paid for and distributed the first Bibles? The devil did. That's music by Claudio Monteverdi. That was written in 1607. It's called a toccata, but it was essentially the overture for what's generally acknowledged to be the first operatic masterpiece, Orfeo, which was staged in Mantua at the palace, the ducal palace of the Gonzaga family. Francesco Gonzaga was the particular person who put that on. He was competing with his brother Ferdinand, who'd been there and had operas of his own put on, and Francesco wanted to equal him. So he got Monteverdi to write Orfeo, which was a huge hit. And just to rub it in, we're not really talking about this necessarily, it's a communications kind of issue, just to rub it into Ferdinand. Every time Francesco went anywhere from then on, he used that fanfare as kind of a personal family jingle. So if Francesco was going to arrive at the market, you'd hear the instruments play, da-da-da-da, and he'd enter in, just to show that he was right. The beginning of media, right there. Now, Monteverdi was born in Cremona in 1567. He was brilliant and precocious, and he published just about everything he wrote, starting with a set of madrigals when he was 15. By 1613, he was the leading musician in Venice, director at St. Mark's Cathedral. And Venice was also home to the best and busiest music publishers and printers in Italy. Venice printed more music than all the rest of Europe combined at that time. And the Venetians used a musical child of Gutenberg's process. It was very complicated, but they were masters at it, where every note and every stem and every rest had its own little slug, little bit of type. And it was much faster than music written by hand, and much neater as well. So they were prolific. But despite their success, the printer's success, times were hard. In the 1620s, Venice's economy, in fact, all of Italy's economy, was just about destroyed. As you'll see throughout the evening, this recession, which was enormous and long-lasting, had a huge impact on all the musical life of Europe for the next 200 years. But the immediate effect was that the merchant class, the people who were buying music for their own use at home, disappeared. Well, there were three reasons, main reasons for this economic slowdown. One was that since Columbus's voyage across the Atlantic, Italy's ports were no longer the main ports for Europe. Shipping business around the Mediterranean wasn't as important anymore because ships were going from Lisbon to the New World, and Italy was sort of out of the picture. And even though the shipping was way down, Italy still had three levels of constantly warring government. There were three different sets of armies. There was the papal army, the Pope had his own army then, and there was the Holy Roman Empire, which was neither, because it was secular and it was based in Austria, but there you go, they had an army. And then every city-state had its own army as well, and they were constantly fighting each other, even though there was no money in the economy to support any of it. And that leads to the third main point in the economic slowdown, which was that the ruling class had completely lost touch with, well, how lucky they were and how unstable the peasantry that were supporting them was. So it was a time of extreme instability, but musicians persevered. And there's one composer, a musician, who really typifies the time and who seemed to thrive on that instability, and that is Alessandro Stradella. He was born in a little town called Vignola. His dad was the mayor, at least until the army arrived, and they had to leave in the middle of the night. And that was 1639, right in the middle of all this fighting. And he was a brilliant musician and an incorrigible womanizer and incredibly impulsive. He seems to have just been inexplicably impulsive. And it could be because he grew up around cannon fire all his childhood. Hard to say. As a young man in Rome, for example, he and his friend Vulpio, who was a castrato, cheated. Well, they did it a few times. They had this marriage swindle they'd do where they'd find a rich widow and convince her that they had arranged marriage with an attractive and wealthy young man and get her to pay them for it and then take off. They did it a few times and got away with it. Didn't even have to leave Rome. But then the third time, the guy that they chose as the groom was a cousin of the papal secretary of state. And that was dumb, because the papal secretary of state was really mad about that, and Stradella and Vulpio had to leave town in a hurry. But since he was leaving, he decided he'd bring along Agnes von Ufula with him, who was the sexy mistress of a visiting nobleman. She went with him. This is another thing in the Stradella story. Women apparently were really drawn to this guy. He had a record. You know, there was no secret about what kind of a rogue he was, but they went with him, several of them. Willingly, knowingly, took off with this guy. Anyway, the nobleman to whom, until she met Stradella, Agnes was involved, was really not happy at this and sent a group of goons after him. And they caught up with him. Agnes and Stradella were hiding in a convent. Hard to imagine how a convent let them in, but there you go. And when he got out, they stabbed him several times and left him for dead. But he didn't die. He persevered. In fact, he was off not too long after that to a new job in Genoa at the local theater as the guy in charge of, and this was his title, preparing the female singers. You can easily imagine Stradella looking heavenward and saying, what have I done to deserve this? Thank you. You may wonder what kind of a place would welcome a guy like Stradella, but Genoa was fairly morally confused at the time, and at least in terms of our judgment. For example, violent crime was fairly common. There's one case of a man who was stabbed to death, and the reason for his murder was that he had been overheard talking about having seen a noblewoman in the nude. That was enough, and the courts issued no punishment to the killer. By contrast, dressmakers were under severe supervision. They had to have designs approved by city council to make sure they weren't too expensive looking. Carriages were the same. If you went out with too many jewels, too much gold on your carriage, you got in trouble with the law. With the peasantry so poor, showing off was considered irresponsible. Another issue was hairdressers. Genoan men suspected their wives of going to the hairdressers just to enjoy having their faces and their hair touched, and that was considered beyond the pale. So Stradella loved Genoa. It was a place made for him. He put together a posse with Vulpio, the castrato, and a hunchbacked violinist and a hairdresser, naturally. And he wrote operas and masses, performs as a singer and a violinist. He wrote great music. This is the thing that's really bizarre about this, is while he's on the run, or womanizing, or hairdressing, or whatever he's doing, he's writing really influential music that had a big impact on many of the great Baroque masters to follow, Handel, Vivaldi, and Corelli. All the time he's leading life as a scoundrel. But not too long after that, his luck ran out. There was an actress who was pregnant from a local priest, and who was... She was taken in by a nobleman, and the nobleman decided she needed some music lessons. Again, you gotta wonder what these people were thinking. So when she decided she liked her teacher, Stradella, better than the nobleman who was paying for the lessons, he got really upset, and his three sons caught up with Stradella in the plaza, in the piazza, as it's called, in Genoa, and they stabbed him. He was dead before he hit the ground. So Stradella's life was full of contrast. While cheating and whoring and running around, he still managed to meet commissions for jolly and joyous and fun music for family events like this one. This is music from a boating entertainment. It's mentioned in one of his final letters. A boating entertainment that was to follow a wedding at the Genoa Parish Church. Thank you. So as armies all over Italy fought each other, and the courts were worrying about hairstyles and the economy sank, two important areas of the music business began to shift dramatically. One was music publishing. A technology war of sorts broke out, like a Beta versus VHS or Mac versus IBM. It was a question when there were a bunch of different ways of doing things, and the market had to decide which it preferred. The Venetian idea of the sort of Gutenberg process for music publishing, where you take little bits for the note heads and little stems and little rests all across a stave, was up against the process that was being practiced in Northern Europe, and that was engraving. So instead of setting up little bits of type for each note and rest, engravers just literally wrote the whole page of music by carving notes and symbols into a thin wax coating that was over copper. And then they'd put the copper in an acid bath, and that would make a negative image in the copper of the music page that had been written into the wax. And they'd use that with ink to print over and over again. It's a very old process and a very simple one. And although it lacked all the mechanical flash of the leaded type printing presses, it worked, and composers generally liked it. So the music engraving process was perfected by a French-born Protestant, a Huguenot, named Estienne Roger, who set up in Amsterdam, after his family had to flee France, in 1686. Roger produced 500 titles in his 30 years of engraving, all carefully and beautifully done, but his success also came from an acute business sense. Roger had agents all across Europe, Holland, Brussels, Paris, Germany, and England, and they distributed his publications in their countries, and they kept an eye out for music that they thought he should be publishing back in Amsterdam, because there was no copyright law at the time. So if he found a nice piece that somebody else had already printed, then he'd print it himself and say it was his, and there was nothing to stop him. Did very well that way. So using that system, he began to woo away some of Italy's greatest composers, including Alessandro Scarlatti, who we'll hear from next. But first, though, there was another technology battle going on within music, and that was between two prominent instruments, the trumpet and the violin. As you heard in the Stradella piece we just heard, they were really considered equals at the time in terms of the prominence they'd be given and the way they could sound, the way they competed with each other. The violin had been considered kind of a dance instrument, rough and harsh sounding, and suited to peasant entertainments. And the trumpet was similar, but from a military perspective. It had started making the transition from the battlefield to the concert hall through church, where composers were looking for a sort of, you know, onward Christian soldiers kind of approach. So the trumpet from Scarlatti's time was a kind of adjustable bugle with crooks and tubes of various lengths, and chromatic notes could be reached by bending notes with the lip. Of both of those instruments, the trumpet and the violin, they were both trying to match the emotion that could be expressed with the human voice. Thank you. Now, the history of the violin in 16th and 17th century Italy is really the history of music and of Europe itself. As far back as 1500, Paris and Venice were in competition for the role of cultural capital, or at least musical capital, of Europe. Parisians favored the gentle sounds of the viol, which is an ancestor of the cello, but the Venetians favored the brash sound of the violin. And in 1536, the Italian princess from the other Italian family, not the Gonzagas who had the family fanfare, but the de' Medicis, who actually kind of won that battle in the end. But anyway, one of their princesses, Catherine de' Medici, became Queen of France. Well, she became Queen of France through an incredibly twisted number of things, but at least two of them were unfortunate deaths. One was a jousting accident. One heir to the throne was killed in a jousting accident, which would have had some honor connected to it. The last one before Catherine got to be queen had a little less distinction for the way for a potential king to die, and that was he collapsed after drinking ice water following a game of tennis. Not sure exactly what happened, but Catherine was there, and that made her queen. Didn't matter. She was queen of France. But she was never really very happy in Paris. She didn't feel she fit in. She wasn't a very popular queen. And she missed the sounds of home. So about 1540s, there was a violinist with a wonderful name of Balthazar de Beaujoyeux, came through Paris with a band of violinists from Italy, and she immediately fell in love with the sound, which reminded her of home, and she ended up buying a set of 38 string instruments from the Amati family workshop in Cremona. It was a commercial coup for the violin and for the Amatis. Their workshop dominated violin making for the next century. And as music became more complex and varied in sound, the violin began to win even more followers, mostly because of the qualities that had been keeping it down in the Parisian court prior to that. It was loud, and it could play alongside the trumpet and the human voice, where the viol would have been drowned out. But even with the violin making business doing well, Cremona itself was still not a happy place. The same economic slowdown that had made Stradella's life so bumpy spread to Cremona in 1620. And then the plague ravaged the city, and Cremona was literally almost deserted. Of the Amati family, once a busy, thriving family in the workshop, only one remained. It was Niccolo. But the demand for violins kept up from across Europe, so Amati took on apprentices. And one of those was a 12-year-old named Antonio Stradivari. Stradivari's arrival as a master violin maker was one of two final steps in the violin's conquest of Europe and of music. The other step was a wave of Italian violin virtuosos, And the first of those, and the greatest, was Arcangelo Corelli. Now, like the engraver Estienne Roger, Corelli's fame spread largely because of agents. In this case, his agents, if you can call it that, were students that talked about his violin playing and put their name on his resume, if you can say that, or use them as a reference. He was so respected and famous that saying you had studied with Corelli was enough to more or less get you the job, now, even if it wasn't true. And we know this because the number of musicians from the period who have Corelli listed as their teacher is so high that it's impossible. He would have had to have been teaching for his entire life, full time, to meet that many lessons with that many violinists. Corelli's influence was enormous, as much through his published music as through his own playing. And this is where the technology takes a remarkable role. Corelli's Opus 5 violin sonatas presented an entirely new approach. I mean, you'll hear as we listen to this music, the demands and the expectations and the emotional depth asked of the violin all of a sudden goes way, way up. If you just remember the kind of violin playing that was in the music we heard by Stradella, and then listen to this Corelli piece, it is astonishing how much it changed in a really short space of time. And that is because of Corelli's great artistry and because his music was so widely disseminated. And the reason Corelli's Opus 5 traveled so far, so fast, is that it was published by Estienne Roger, the engraver from Amsterdam.
Thank you.